Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Welcome to Background Briefing, Trita Parsi.
Thank you for having me.
And we're on the eve of the P5+1talks with Iran being held in Turkey, P5 being the permanent five at the United Nations and the plus one being Germany. This is, of course, a breakthrough in itself that talks are taking place. The head of Iran's National Security Council, Saeed Jalali, suggested on Wednesday that its representatives would present new initiatives. Do you have any sense of what new initiatives the Iranians may have up their sleeves?
No, and they've been very mum about that in the past as well. And oftentimes, the new initiatives have not been particularly new or particularly creative. They have put quite interesting proposals on the table in the past, but that was usually before the Ahmadinejad era, in which they had some relatively creative and at least intriguing proposals that were put on the table. At that time, though, however, the Bush administration was in power and there wasn't any interest in the U.S. side to pursue them. But the new proposals that have emerged out of Iran during the period of Ahmadinejad have neither been new nor particularly interesting for the other side.
Well, as you know, Senator Lieberman, McCain, and Graham are doing everything they can to frustrate these talks from even taking place. And the Lieberman amendment is going to probably be debated in the Senate next week. What's your understanding of why there is this constituency here in the United States to prevent even talks from taking place, whether or not these talks are successful?
Because there are those who have a belief that the compromise that is a likely compromise to come out of talks is not conducive to their interests. The Israelis, for instance, fear successful diplomacy more than they fear a collapse of the talks because they believe that the negotiations would lead to a situation in which Iran would have some limited enrichment capability, which in their view would turn it into a virtual nuclear power. It would shift the balance of power in the region, and it would reduce U.S.-Iran relation tensions without reducing Israeli-Iranian tensions, and in that sense, leave Israel abandoned in the region facing a hostile Iran. So there are elements both in the U.S., in Israel, and in Iran who actually prefer either the continuation of the status quo or even a confrontation to a resolution of this conflict.
And how far, in terms of that constituency, Trita Parsi, that you just mentioned inside Iran, we understand the constituency here in the United States, loosely described as the neoconservatives. What is the constituency in Iran and how much is it, how close is it, or does it include the supreme leader?
The constituency in Iran is a bit different in the sense that you have both elements who are opposed to the idea or who are very fearful that if Iran negotiates with the West, it would be the beginning of the end of the regime. Then you have elements that are not necessarily ideologically opposed to talk, but who believe that whoever manages to resolve tensions with the U.S. would win a lot of political capital within Iranian society, and they don't want their political rivals to get that credit. So they have undermined and created obstacles to a solution in order to prevent their political rivals from getting the credit of resolving this issue.
But the Supreme Leader recently, and when he met with the Turkish leader a couple of weeks ago in Tehran, presumably the Turkish leader was laying the groundwork for these talks that are taking place in Turkey. The Supreme Leader said that it's un-Islamic to build an atomic bomb. What do you make of that?
Well, this is something that the Iranians have been saying for quite some time. And not too much attention has been given to that in the West in the past. I personally don't believe that such a statement, even if it carries some religious weight, which it does, is sufficient. I think the approach that needs to be done is to trust and verify, or perhaps even mistrust and verify. But the real key word here is verification. making sure that there are verification processes in place that ensures that the Iranians simply cannot cheat and move towards weaponization without being caught well in time. Now, if they say that this is against their beliefs or interpretation of Islam, we can treat that as a positive and see if we can build something on it. And I think that's exactly what the administration is trying to do. But it can, in and of itself, never replace the verification to make sure that their words are matched by their actions.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Now, the clock is ticking in terms of the sanctions on Iran. They've never been this intense, and they're about to get fairly intense through the summer when the Europeans stop purchasing oil. Already, it's next to impossible for Iran to make international bank transactions and therefore get paid for their oil. But I guess the real issue here is once the Asian refineries, and you've written about this, Trita Parsi, once the Asian refineries shift away from Iranian oil, it's unlikely that they want to double the cost by shifting back to Iranian oil. And at that threshold is when things really get painful for Iran. They've always indicated defiance in the past. I mean, the only time I recall compromise, if you will, was when the Ayatollah Khamenei himself ended the Iran-Iraq war, and he referred to that as being like drinking poison. Do you think it's going to be another moment like that?
I don't believe it's going to be another moment like that because Iran is not in that weak of a position. I think there is a temptation and a very dangerous and counterproductive temptation on both sides to not really negotiate, but try to use the negotiations to impose on the other terms of capitulation. And neither side is in that type of a position of overwhelming strength to be able to succeed with something like that. So I think it is a mistake, and I think it would be very dangerous to go to the table and have extensive demands, but not offer anything in return, particularly when it comes to sanctions. And I think in my own conversations with diplomats from the other P5 states, it's been quite clear that there is not an agreement within the P5 as to what position to take, what strategy to use, what tactics to employ. In fact, it's even reported today that the Russians have come out and said that there's not going to be a coordination meeting between the P5 because they don't agree on how to pursue these negotiations. And it really raises the question as to what is the purpose of going to the table now? We waited for so long, and there's no coordination between five. Is this going to be just a U.S.-Iran negotiation? What exactly is it going to be?
Well, I think that's a fair assumption. If the P5 being the permanent five at the UN Security Council, including Russia and China, it's unlikely that there'd be any agreement going in. And, you know, it's not a majority situation, is it, where the French, the British and the US and plus one Germany, it's not a question where they're going to be voting, right?
Certainly, but it's not just a division between the West and the P5 and the US is actually... and China and Russia, I'm sorry, there is a question of the French and the Europeans actually not being on the same page as the Americans. The French have taken a position, for instance, that is much closer to the position taken by the Bush administration. So there is a division even at that level. I personally do have a suspicion that part of the reason why the Obama administration is very eager to move towards diplomacy right now, and I'm a person who has been for long on the track record, having a long track record of supporting diplomacy. But it seems like a key motivating factor for the administration right now is because they need just some talks in order to push down oil prices, which will be of significant importance for their re-election bid. And that actually seems to be perhaps a stronger motivating factor right now and a driver of this than an actual strategy, tactic, some sort of a process that gives us confidence that this actually could lead to a solution.
Well, even short of getting some kind of agreement or finding some way to lower the price of oil, and frankly, it's pretty clear to me from interviews I've done that the real driver of the price of oil is happening on Wall Street. It has nothing to do with the Middle East. In fact, the Saudi oil minister only a week ago said that the price of oil has no bearing on reality as far as he's concerned. But that aside, it would seem to me that there's an incentive in a way for both sides to sort of draw this thing out. Obama doesn't want anything to happen before the elections in any kind of military action, obviously. And presumably the Iranians are, if you're saying that the sanctions don't worry them, what's their incentive to...
No, sanctions actually do worry them quite a lot. They say that it doesn't, but I do believe that it does. But they have an incentive as well to go to the table because perhaps an interim deal can be found in which some of these sanctions would be delayed or would be lifted, and that would be beneficial to their short-term calculations. But also, if they don't come to the table, that would clearly create some other forms of problems. Both sides do have an interest in making sure that this doesn't lead to a military confrontation, and if there are ongoing talks, that's going to reduce the likelihood of the Israelis being able to engage in any unilateral bombings. So there is an interest in making sure that at least it works in the short term, but it doesn't seem to necessarily be driven by primarily of a desire to actually reach a deal right now, but because of other tactical and political reasons.
But surely and I would suspect that this might well happen in the negotiations, that the Iranians may tie inspection demands or demands to close down Fordo, the underground facility near Qom. Surely they will tie that to Israel's signature of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, plus the additional protocol. And if Israel doesn't sign these treaties, which is highly unlikely, Iran can say, well, why should we agree to anything?
Well, Iran is already is already a signatory to the NPT, so I don't think it is in a position to renegotiate its NPT membership.
Well, I was referring to the additional protocols.
It's quite clear that they're going to throw in Israel into the mix every once in a while because of many other reasons and other factors. But I don't think the Iranians necessarily want the Israelis to suddenly come in and sign the NPT, because that would probably mean that Israel would join the NPT for having states, and that would probably not be what the Iranians are desiring.
Sure, but just rhetorically, they're in the position to argue that they are acting to promote President Barack Obama's vision of a nuclear-free Middle East.
And it's not unlikely that they would make those arguments. I don't know how seriously they would push to have negotiations go in that direction, however. I mean, it's an argument that they would use to point out that there are some significant flaws and double standards in the Western position. But whether they would push for it as an actual outcome of the talks, I'm a bit skeptical about.
Well, just in closing, Trita Parsi, in some of the more recent interviews I've done, there's some alarming information that's come forth. I don't know whether you read the article in Foreign Policy about Israel's forging ties with Azerbaijan and the possibility of using air bases in Azerbaijan not to launch an attack on Iran from, but to make an air attack on Iran plausible, because the Israelis could refuel on their return leg, land and refuel after the bombing run. There's also, people have told me in the intelligence community, that it's also possible that Israel may have made arrangements in Iraqi Kurdistan to land and refuel on a return leg, because up until now, it's often been said by military analysts that it would be extremely technically difficult for Israel to launch an attack at that distance and without in-flight refueling, which would be impossible. Do you think these factors that have been brought up, particularly by the article in Foreign Policy by Mark Harris, do you think they are something to be concerned about?
I wouldn't say that the story isn't true or is true, but I don't believe it is a game changer. I don't believe that even if that additional refueling capability would really change the picture that dramatically. I think what it does show, however, is that the Israelis, or let me put it this way, what it does show is that this would be a military confrontation that would be extremely difficult to contain. It would be having a high likelihood of expanding into areas that are quite problematic, and as a result, as a result, it would be very dangerous and unpredictable for the United States itself.
Well, even the very hawkish Israeli Foreign Minister Lieberman said as much, that there'd be unforeseen and catastrophic consequences of an attack on a war with Iran.
Yes, it's very difficult for them to pretend otherwise.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you for having me.
Again, Dr. Trita Parsi is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and the author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. Let's now take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the so-called ceasefire in Syria.
Did it all get real? I guess it's real enough. They got refrigerators full of blood. Another century spent pointing guns at anything that moves. Sometimes I worry that I've lost. My twitching muscles, teeth, my flipping thoughts. I never really dreamed.